This recording has been released into the public domain by the Bonson Institute, where we aim to bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ.
We have two more elements of presuppositional or transcendental argumentation that are touched upon in Michael Martin's book, The Philosophical Justification of Atheism. And we'll begin our class today by looking at them in short order. The first one is his discussion of Taylor's version of the teleological argument. And for this, let's turn to pages 146 to 152 in the book. 146 to 152. Once again, it's obvious that what we're looking at is not a transcendental argument. It's not as though we have an opportunity to see Michael Martin directly deal with a transcendental argument. The closest he comes is maybe C.S. Lewis's Critique of Naturalism, or the argument against objectivity in ethics if you don't have a divine command approach and so forth. That's really the closest we're going to come, and it's very evident that what we're looking at now in the teleological argument is not intended by the author being examined for it to be anything like an apologetic that Christians would use, or even transcendental in its force, arguing this is the precondition for making intelligible what we are doing. And Martin, when he looks at Richard Taylor, quotes him to the effect that this is not necessarily a proof that any particular kind of God exists, or that even you have to have a religious approach to your metaphysic. So I know that. Whatever features of Taylor's argument that don't fit in with or don't make claims consistent with the transcendental kind of argument, I'm not going to pay attention to, and I'm going to purposely ride roughshod over this a bit. And what we do look at in terms of Taylor, I'm going to ask you to try to imagine what if this were being presented, though, as part of a case in a transcendental argument. Now, his teleological argument, if you remember, is summarized nicely in this illustration. This is a question of whether it's an illustration to be taken as an analogy, the foundation for a conclusion, or whether it is showing us a more general principle, which principle becomes then the premise leading to the conclusion. But anyway, he says, imagine that you are riding into a town, you're in a railway coach, and when you look out the window, you see white stone scattered on the hillside in a pattern resembling. It's important that it's put that way, because we don't want to assume that someone has put these here and is trying to give us a message. But if you saw this pattern being in a railway car coming into a town, and it said the British Railway welcomes you to Wales, he says, although you realize that it's logically possible that this arrangement came about by chance, you would be justified in thinking that these stones were purposely arranged. It is possible, of course, that the stones could have rolled down the hill one by one over the centuries and formed this interesting pattern, but it's highly unlikely. Isn't he right? I mean, let's imagine you had some kind of real personal animus and vendetta against the British railway system, and you couldn't imagine that they would ever do something like welcome people to a town. I mean, they're such rotten people. And on top of that, you can't imagine they would go to the effort to get stones white in color arranged and so forth. And so what you say is, well, I can account for how this one white stone might have rolled down the hill and gotten this place. And then I can account for how that white stone may have rolled down the hill and gotten this place. And on and on and on and on. And you say all of your account doesn't require any human intervention, where people are purposely shoving the stones that way or hoping they'll finally end up in that pattern or whatever. But rather, it all comes down to something that can be very easily, we won't say by chance necessarily, because maybe natural laws are involved, but nevertheless, randomly, from the standpoint of any human intention, randomly these stones ended up one by one in the place. And then it so happens when you look at it, there's a message there, or what can be taken as a message. Now, what Taylor is asking is, which is the more rational approach? Or would it be justified for a person to say, I don't think this is random. Even though it can be explained by natural law principles, I don't think it's random. I think there is a message. Now, to say there's a message is to say that somebody is communicating. Some being of some sort has an intention. And so that's why coded information, letters of the alphabet, are a code whereby information can be communicated. Now, what Taylor says here, and this is the interesting part of his version of the teleological argument, this is right in the middle of 146, he says, if you conclude that the stones did form the pattern by chance, he says, okay, now on that interpretation, though it may not seem very likely, and other people will not be considered irrational to take a different approach, he said, on that interpretation, then it would be irrational for you to conclude that you have information that you're entering Wales from what you see in the stones. Now, this is what makes it not like a normal teleological argument. It begins to resemble in construction a transcendental sort of argument from internal critique. If you accept this premise, then you cannot make sense of what you are doing in letting these stones be, quote, conveyors of a message. Okay? If I can give you the Vantillian analog. If I'm arguing with an atheist, I could say to him, well, I could understand how you might try to explain everything in terms of principles of randomness. However, I can't understand that once you accept that approach to explanation, how anything turns out to convey a message. Okay? So that's why we're looking at this as a quasi-transcendental argument. It's an internal critique. You can't have both of these things given your approach, given your assumption or presupposition. As Taylor sees it, our sense organs and brains and nervous system are, quote, things of the most amazing and bewildering complexity and delicacy, end of quote. That's certainly not an understatement. If you do want to have just some evidence at your disposal to make unbelievers uncomfortable, I would suggest you do study things like the way the eye and the brain work with one another. I mean, just the complexity of it. Not because a person could not presume on certain rational principles to escape you if you're trying to argue with them, but I still find people, because they're made in the image of God, when you present that kind of thing to them, it does make them stumble a bit if they want to run away. It's kind of like, wow. But then they can always say nature's a whole lot more ingenious than we thought. I talk about that in my weekend conference. But anyway, Taylor says it really is remarkable. He maintains that not much progress has been made by science in understanding how human beings perceive the world. And he's right about that, too. You talk to sophomoric type of college skeptics about Christianity, and they'll tell you, you know, how science, that the brain will account for, you know, what we do and what we think and so forth. Well, I mean, as a proleptic or eschatological claim down the line that we're going to do this, you know, you can't keep somebody from saying that. But if anybody thinks science has done much of that, they don't know the state of contemporary neurological study. I mean, it is an utter mystery to people how the mind forms thoughts at all, much less can discriminate between thinking about a horse and thinking about body surfing. Because when you look at what's happening in the brain when someone's thinking about a horse and when someone's thinking about body surfing, there doesn't seem to be anything we can latch on to distinguish. Okay? So I'm not saying it can't be done. All I'm saying is don't let anybody bamboozle you, you know, with just generalized claims. They all, well, science will explain. They say, well, they're not doing a real good job of it right now, although there are plenty of people committed to the project. I know that. And so he said two things which we shouldn't have trouble with. One, there is a wondrous complexity here. Not that that rules out the chance explanation. There's a wondrous complexity. And two, we don't have a whole lot of good detailed information from the naturalist on how this comes about. But his argument, again, is deeper than that. His argument has to do with this. If you look at the very last line on the page, how is it we're going to take account of the eye and the brain perceiving and understanding, he maintains it is, quote, sometimes almost irresistible when considering such a thing as the eye to suppose that, however it may have originated, it is constructed in that manner in order to enable its possessor to see. The italicized in order is what's crucial here. Because if you can account for the stones rolling down the mountain, and they just get in that pattern, you wouldn't want to say that they are in order to tell you you're coming to Wales. But our instinctive use of the eye, as though it is in order to give us information about the world, treating it as though it is perceiving something about the world, and beyond that, even actually much harder, how the brain understands concepts and things like that. We just instinctively do this. Later, he will call this epistemological realism. Now, you don't have to be an epistemological realist, however, to feel the thrust of this, that we are all instinctively, shall we say by nature? Well, that would be a pun. We all instinctively operate on an epistemological realist assumption. You know, children have to be taught to doubt that their eyes are not telling them, you know, the true nature of the world or giving them information. You don't have a child grow up who, you know, when they start to think about these things, runs in and says, Mommy, should I assume that my eyes are teaching me something about something beyond my own mind? Again, it takes years of philosophical training to be skeptical like that. So we can accept a whole bunch of what he's doing here. He says we instinctively have the in order to, the epistemological realist approach to things. We see the wondrous complexity that doesn't seem to have any plausible explanation at this point on the part of naturalism. Second paragraph, page 147, first full paragraph. Now, it is possible to suppose that the eye was an accidental, unintended result. In fact, as Taylor says, that's the view of most biologists. They want to appeal to some kind of chance mutations and so forth in the explanation, where there's no purpose behind the development of the eye. However, if we accept the account of evolutionary biology, then Taylor finds it difficult to see how we can rely on our sense organs and brains in the way that we do. Okay? And so this is the fascinating part of the argument. It's the in order to part of it. How could we be using the eye as though it had an in order to, it had some kind of purpose, when there's no purpose in the explanation of what the eye actually is and what it does?
Mm-hmm.
And then the quotation there in the middle of the page, we in fact, whether justifiably or not, rely on them for the discovery of things that we suppose to be true and which we suppose to exist quite independently of those organs themselves. And then at the end of it, so also our senses and all our faculties could be accidental in their origins, and in that case they do not really tell us anything either. But the fact remains that we do trust them without the slightest reflection on the matter. Okay, so I'm debating an atheist, and I say, the problem is, you need a worldview in terms of which you can make sensible, you can account for your reliance on your sense organs, as though they're telling you something. Now, I know that you do rely on them that way. You know, your practice shows that. Of course, the argument would be taken away. If anybody said, oh, well, you've taken me wrong, I'm really an utter irrationalist, and I don't trust my senses. I say, oh, okay, well, then there goes that argument. Of course, once a person does that, he's given me the best argument of all. Why do I hold to Christianity and I don't hold to your view? Because you told me your view is irrational. So, I mean, that's not a real good escape to run to. But given the fact that people do trust their senses and they engage in scientific inference and all that, the presuppositionalist says, what can account for that? And then, particularly in terms of an internal critique, can your worldview comport with what you're doing? So I kind of like this. Given your view of the accidental development of the I, what I don't understand is why you're assuming that the I is used to get information about something beyond your brain. Why are you treating it as though it's communicating, if you will, to use the metaphor? And then Taylor puts it very well at the end of the paragraph after the block quotation, very end. He says, many people assume that their sensory and cognitive faculties are reliable and that the evolutionary account of the origin of their cognitive faculties is correct. What I like about this, and Michael Martin, I don't think, doesn't really pick up on it sufficiently, and it's the same sort of problem that Gordon Stein had when I was arguing with him, at least in our written correspondence, is none of us have any trouble accepting both these things are true. There are people who assume the reliability of their cognitive faculties and believe the evolutionary account of the origin of those faculties. Yeah, we know that. But as Taylor goes on to say, the problem is this. These people are irrational in doing that. You can do an internal critique and say, oh, I don't doubt that you're believing both these things. What I doubt is that those two beliefs can comport with each other. And then the next paragraph is what I was referring to when I said, obviously, Taylor's not treating this in as strong a form as he could as a transcendental argument. One of the clues, I'm not going to say it's the only one, but a fairly reliable mark that help you distinguish between a transcendental form of argumentation and one that is not, or more in the standard fashion or evidential fashion, natural theology fashion of argumentation is this. Does the person who's putting forth these considerations see them as independent considerations that establish only one aspect of the worldview, so that you have other aspects that you have to build up separately? See, that is not the mark of a presuppositionalist. Even though we may argue sometimes, like other people do, I would appeal to these sorts of things like Taylor, but he's presenting this as though it's a step-by-step-by-step thing in terms of whatever metaphysical worldview you're going to have. But I don't do it that way, and I don't think the Bible would have us do it that way. We rather begin with a totally developed worldview. And we say, okay, now what's the alternative? And whenever anybody has an alternative, we do an internal critique to show that on this illustration or that illustration, whatever it may be, that their worldview does not comport with the rational procedures and practices in their life, but it does comport with our own. We're not appealing to that illustration as though that's one brick in the argument that is finally going to be a house when we get done. Do you all understand what I'm saying? We're beginning with a house, and we can say, hey, you can cook dinner in this house. Let's look at your house, and now I'll take one element of your house and show you you can't cook dinner given the way you've put your house together. But I'm not saying I'm building my house piece by piece by piece, and the first piece is, how would you cook dinner in a house, and so forth. So Taylor shows that he's not approaching it transcendentally. Nevertheless, I think it's legitimate for us to use it and say, well, we could still pursue this and strengthen it by putting it in a framework that is comparison of worldviews rather than attempt to one by one prove or build up a worldview. Page 148, about a third of the way down. If Taylor is correct, one could not embrace evolutionary or other naturalist accounts of our sensory and cognitive faculties and yet claim to be a rational atheist. Since many atheists do wish to embrace such naturalistic accounts and yet claim to be rational and justified in atheistic beliefs, Taylor's argument has some bite. Yeah, well, let Van Til put it to you, and it has more than bite. It's a ferocious argument. Consequently, although a refutation of his argument is not necessary to the refutation of theism, it is indirectly relevant to the defense of one type of atheism. Well, that sentence is crucial. First of all, he says it's not necessary. But if it's a transcendental challenge, it is necessary to refute. And what have we found in the last couple of days of our seminar? Interestingly, he never looks at the toughest case he has to deal with straight on, does he? And since he won't take Taylor in a transcendental form, he can say, well, it's not really necessary to deal with this. But if it were presented as, you can't make sense out of rationality on the evolutionary naturalistic approach, then he would have to, wouldn't he? Because that would constitute proof that God exists. But isn't the whole idea in the first part of the book to show that there are no good proofs that God exists? So you see what I'm getting at? By not putting it in its strongest form, he's really taking a shortcut home. And then the second observation, he says, the only reason he's going to deal with it is because it's relevant to a defense of one type of atheism. Well, I wrote down, and the only type relevant in apologetics. What he's talking about is, well, a person can be an irrational atheist. Well, no one ever doubted that. But in apologetics, we're arguing about rationality. So now if you want to be a rational atheist, you'd better come up with an argument because we've got a transcendental refutation of your position. You can't make sense of what you call rationality given your evolutionary naturalistic hypothesis. Okay, now we have some criticisms. Can somebody get around this argument? The first attempt is from Jan Narveson. And on one understanding of the argument, Narveson says, you can hardly escape it. Only intelligent beings mean something. Things do not mean, if you're taking meaning in the sense of linguistic communication. Since if some marks mean something, they could not be the result of non-purposeful forces, then. Okay, so here's somebody who feels the thrust of this, that if meaning is construed in a linguistic sense, then you are not going to be able to give a non-purposive explanation. And every attempt is going to fall short that doesn't incorporate intentions. But then Narveson points out there are other senses for mean, not just the linguistic analogy of meaning. And, of course, he's right. The example that's given here is not uncommon. You say, you know, those dark clouds mean it's going to rain. Where meaning now is the assertion of a natural correlation between this and the thing you said it means. Okay? Example I use in other situations is, you know, this pattern of tread wear means that your car is not aligned. Well, it doesn't mean it because the treads are speaking to us. It means it because we've taken this as a natural correlation between tread wear of this sort and an unaligned front end of your car. On the sense of natural correlation, Narveson said it's not irrational for someone to suppose both that what is meant by dark clouds is rain, there's a natural correlation, and also that the dark clouds are the result of non-purposeful forces. The next paragraph, Narveson says about Taylor, his argument rests on an analogy between the sense in which an arrangement of marks tells us or informs us of something, and the sense in which our eyes or other organs tell us something. Well, that shouldn't seem all that questionable to you. I wrote down the point of similarity in my margin here. If you're going to talk about analogy of this means that, where you have different kinds of meaning, it's because both draw unseen connections according to some rule or template, if you want to put it that way, in order to reach the conclusion. In both cases, where if I write a note to my son, get eggs at the market, you know, and then he looks at these squiggles on a page and he goes, I think this has meaning. Dad wants me to get eggs at the market. That in that case, and in the case when we say, I mean, my son says, Dad means get eggs at the market, and when we say, those clouds mean rain, in both cases, the analogy and the reason why we use the word meaning is because we are drawing an unseen connection between two things. what's the unseen connection in the case of the note about eggs at the market? Here's squiggles on a page. That's all you've got. And then the other thing that's supposed to be meant by that is either the intention that I have or my expectation my son is going to buy eggs or the buying of eggs. I mean, you can construe it in different ways, but the point is, how do you get buying of eggs and squiggles on a page together? By, quote, meaning. These squiggles mean that. Well, how do you get it's going to rain, you know, this afternoon from looking at dark clouds? Because you're so accustomed habitually to doing that, isolate that from your habits and just ask, do dark clouds in and of themselves have any connection to rain this afternoon? Well, if they do, let's say, oh yeah, there's a, you know, point by point by point physical connection. Even on that view, the point is you don't see the result right now, do you? So we say dark clouds mean rain this afternoon and squiggles on a page mean buy eggs at the store because we are drawing an unseen connection. Now, are you allowed to draw just any connection? Is that enough to say that it's an unseen? I mean, that's pretty significant in itself to make an analogy. But it's not just that an unseen connection, because it's not just any old unseen connection. I mean, I wouldn't expect my son to receive those squiggles on the page and say, oh, mow the lawn. And nor would we want to say, well, dark clouds mean something. It must mean the Dodgers are going to win the World Series. No, you can't get from dark clouds to the Dodgers are going to win the World Series, nor can you get from the particular English words in my note, mow the lawn. Why is that? Because you're drawing a connection that follows rules. They may be customary rules, they may be stipulated rules, they may be habits, they may be natural connections, whatever it may be, but there's some template or rule that governs how this means that. Okay? From what I've just said, I don't think Narveson, you know, has anything to take away from Taylor. And then Taylor can say, how is it that unpurposeful marks mean anything? Because in all meaning, you are drawing an unseen connection according to a rule. Somebody was going to say, oh, right here.
Yeah, for an unbeliever to talk about meaning, even in the non-linguistic sense, would have to presuppose some kind of preconditions of intelligibility.
Right.
They can't even talk about meaning in terms of nature, mm-hmm. because all of nature reflects God's character.
Yeah, I'm really appreciative that you're pushing harder here. I hope everybody sees the significance of this. What we have been doing the last few minutes is letting the unbeliever get away with a little bit. We say, okay, let's just assume that you can make intelligible the sentence, dark clouds mean rain. We could, however, rather than say, you can't escape the argument about the white stones or things like that just by saying we can talk of meaning in another way because you haven't escaped the real issue. We could also take the approach of saying, well, actually, dark clouds don't mean rain. Given your worldview, they don't mean anything because on your worldview, there's no meaning. There are no unseen connections by means of a template or rule. So, right on. The next argument, page 149, about the middle of the page, and I'm not living up to my promise to myself to go fast. I have to go faster. Sorry. The argument is, I better not look at the book because then I slow down. The argument is, but don't you understand that in order to understand the meaning of a written expression, you have to look at the marks and understand their pattern. But in the case of the eye being a reliable organ for understanding, you don't have to look at the eye and understand its pattern. That's embarrassingly bad as an argument. Because the analogy there, so everybody knows it's apples and oranges, but it's apples and oranges of a much more profound, different sort that he's trying to bring together. Why is it that I have to look at the particular marks on the page to know that it's telling me you're entering, well, not on the page, on the hillside, you're entering Wales or go buy eggs at the market? Well, because in order to distinguish the different messages in language, the letters of the alphabet and the words distinguish the different messages. But when I look at the dark clouds and say they mean rain, I don't have to consider the nature of my visual apparatus in order to see that connection. So that's all that Narveson has told us here. But that's utterly irrelevant. I mean, I think he feels there's something there because we're paying greater attention. And just the question of what is it that communicates the specific message, and the function or the specific structure of the eye is not part of the message. But the marks on the page are part of the message when it comes to language. So let me back up and give you the analogy again. The real question is, how do we know the stones function to convey a message? How do we know that the eye functions to convey, functions to have a message conveyed to us? It is not seeing the particular pattern of marks in the stones or on the page that tells me this is functioning to convey a message. Let me say that again. It's not looking at the particular pattern of the marks. Do we have an A here? Do we have an L here? Do we have an M here? It's not looking at the particular pattern that is necessary for me to know this is functioning to give me a message. Isn't that right? Imagine, go back to my son. I've written him a note, left it down here on the counter, which is what we do in our family. So they come down in the morning, Dad's gone, there's a note there that he wants him to do something, okay? He walks past the note. He may not even look at the words, if you mean by look, focus on O, egg, store, and so forth. But he looks at the note in general, and he knows this is the kind of thing that conveys the message from Dad. Now, do you see? That's what the analogy should be. Now, how is it that using my eyes, I look at anything, and I say, a message is being conveyed. Rain's coming this afternoon, whatever it may be. Again, I don't have to know the particular configuration of the eyes. I don't have to look at the mark or even the apparatus for seeing the mark. All I have to know is there's something going on here that seems like a conveying of message going on here.
It creates a regress problem still, because you mean whatever is interpreting the eye, you mean something's going to interpret it, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, exactly. Y'all understand that? The regress of interpretation. All interpretation's got to stop at some point. And wherever it stops, what you're saying is, I just take for granted this is the sort of thing that calls for interpretation. You know, the example Wittgenstein uses, as others do as well. Imagine children are supposed to learn language ostensibly, okay? So that we build up the vocabulary of child by, when the child's growing, pointing at the object and going, book. And then pointing at something and going, fan. Pointing and so forth. You say, so that's how people learn the meaning of terms. Well, there's only one problem. Where did they learn the meaning of pointing? Yeah, and that's not just a sophistic, I mean, that's a very profound, no. Somehow children are adapted to learning the meaning of terms by means of pointing. Now, somebody say, oh, yeah, we explained that to them. In other words, they understood the words by which we explained the pointing, what do I want to call this? Not tradition, but the custom of pointing. That is, we mean by pointing, the next thing out of my mouth is the name for this thing. They couldn't have learned that verbally if that's the way the pointing is supposed to teach them the meaning of words. And so everyone's got to get to a place where explanation itself is explained, the patterns of explanation. So thanks, Mike, for reminding us of that. Page 150. A little above the middle of the page. Here we have Creel giving an interpretation of Taylor. Without the assumption that our faculties are designed by God to reveal this world, we would have no reason to believe that the evidence of our senses metaphysically means what we normally suppose it does. And then the reference to epistemological realism, you should note that's what we're taking for granted, and that's what's called, that's what we should be calling for an explanation for. Why are you acting like an epistemological realist? And then this principle is offered by Creel, labeled ER. A person's assertion of epistemological realism is rational if and only if the person asserts that there is a God who designed our faculties of sense and cognition to reveal to us the existence and nature of an independently existing world. That looks pretty transcendental. I like that. And then notice what our author does. I want you to stand aside for a minute now and just watch Michael Martin squirm. What does our author do when ER is put out there and I say, hey, that looks like a pretty good argument? He goes, this cannot be a completely correct interpretation of Taylor's views.
ER prime. The big two.
You know what I put down? So what? Perhaps this is a perfecting of the original version of the argument. That's okay. So why don't you deal with the perfected argument rather than worrying about whether this is true to the original? Hasn't he done that everywhere else? Or not every, I won't say everywhere, but in most cases, doesn't he try to perfect arguments and answer them and so forth? Bottom of the page. ER prime is compatible with our faculties of sense and cognition being designed by an entity with attributes very different from those of the traditional God. Well, I circled the word designed and just put down that that doesn't comport with materialism. That there's any designing doesn't comport with materialism. That's the point here. And that's why children can learn to use transcendental arguments, even though they may not know what that big word means. Because the whole point here is, the notion of designing doesn't fit into a world where there's no designing. Now, materialism, on many definitions, means there's no purpose. Everything is explained causally. So, on the worldview that says everything is without purpose, without design, you can't then go on to say something is designed. And then he talks about attributes very different from those of the traditional God. Now, all that's saying is this consideration by itself doesn't settle every question. So what? No argument is intended to settle every question simultaneously. But remember, on my interpretation, I'm not offering this as the first step of developing a Christian worldview rationally, level by level, brick by brick. I've said, I've got a house standing over here, and I can explain why there's meaning, why there's design, and so forth. And I'm suggesting your worldview can't do that at all. And if he says, well, but there may be other worldviews that explain design or attempt to, I say, well, that's fine. We'll deal with them later. But right now, it's just between you and me. You know, mano y mano right here. Don't worry about it. Other guys that are going to come along. And so if he says, well, I can't answer you, but then again, there may be some other religion that can answer you. I say, fine. If you want to take the position of that religionist, then we'll argue that. But right now, it's mano y mano. You got to learn not to let people escape by saying, we haven't answered every question. Say, I never intended to answer every question. I just tried to make life tough for you by showing you can't make sense out of your rational procedures. Notice what Michael Martin says just maybe a quarter of the way down, before the ER double prime. Hence, our assertion of epistemological realism would not be rational. And then he says, in light of this problem, it's only the faintest recognition of it, but you see, he's just granted to us the very point we're trying to make. He's saying, well, that's right. Epistemological realism is not rational. That's a problem. That's a problem. Keep repeating that. He admits that's a problem. All right, now, you've got a problem, Michael Martin. What should you do? Give up your naturalism, right? Let me finish the sentence. In light of this problem, ER prime can be further revised. Now, why would you further revise something that has already been pretty thoroughly refuted? I mean, what would motivate you to do that? Let's just talk about, you know, human behavior at this point.
He knows it hasn't.
Why is he behaving this way?
He knows it hasn't been refuted. Or he's not confident in his reputation.
No, it's the other way around. We've just refuted him. We've just refuted his naturalism. And so what he says is, oh, my assertion of epistemological realism would not be rational then. Well, at that point, you would expect, if people were as rational as, you know, they portray themselves as being, that he'd then just give up his naturalism and say, I've been refuted. He doesn't. Now he says, oh, but I'm going to look further for a principle that will help me. And all I'm asking is, why is he motivated to look further? It's got to be because he's already convinced of his conclusion. He's not approaching this objectively to say, hey, bring on your arguments, let's see where they lead. What he's saying is, I'm not going to let an argument lead that way. I don't want that conclusion, or I'm convinced on other grounds that it's not right, so he's just not going to permit that. He says, one basic problem with ER double prime is that it is difficult to see how one could be justified in asserting that our faculties of sense and cognition are designed to reveal the existence and nature of an independently existing external world. Yeah, that's a problem. Justification's been taken away for that. And then I'm going to jump down to a sentence that is crucial in the middle of this paragraph. It would seem that unless we have some non-empirical way of justifying our belief that our sense and cognitive faculties are designed, it would not be rational to believe that epistemological realism is true. Exactly. Eureka. Exclamation point. Bingo. That's it. You're not going to be able to do this empirically. He admits it. It would seem that unless we have a non-empirical thing. So once again, we're at the crisis point. Michael Martin, you should convert to theism, Christianity, whatever. It's time for you, because you just admitted you have to have a non-empirical way of doing this. But instead, he goes on to say, however, it's difficult to see how such non-empirical justification could be possible.
That's true. It's hard for him to see that.
Yeah, given your presuppositions, which call for you to not allow anything non-empirical, it's very difficult to think it's possible. And this is such a great illustration. This is exactly what apologetics is all about, as Van Til taught us over and over again. When you get a problem in your system, you know, you're going to appeal to what is possible or not possible. And he's already decided that theism isn't possible. In this case, a non-empirical approach to things. And so he is never going to allow his empirical prejudice to be challenged or overthrown. Later on, when we look at his book, The Case Against Christianity, this is going to be the major theme that I have time to teach you. Is you're going to see over and over and over again that when evidence is presented to somebody, there is no way for you to determine which belief he's going to give up. Okay, so we've just shown Michael Martin that he would have to he'd have to have a non-empirical principle to explain this if he's going to be rational. But he's already decided that there is no possibility of a non-empirical way of doing this. So he's going to make an adjustment elsewhere in his system, isn't he? If you believe that the gods are immortal, and that Apollo is a god, and then I give you evidence that Apollo died in battle, you might say, well, that surely shows you that Apollo's not a god. No, because you might say, I'm so committed to Apollo being a god that I guess not all the gods are immortal.
Or he didn't.
And there's not, what's that?
Or he didn't really die.
Yeah, you could also say, it's somebody's fooling me, it's just an illusion, something like that. There's no way, and we're now getting in the man who's supposed to be the rational atheist proponent here, very clear evidence that he operates this way. Every time he gets up against a refutation of himself, he says, let's go somewhere else.
Interesting, that last paragraph, after he reinterprets what Taylor's position was, he claims victory by saying this is hardly an implication of Taylor.
Yes, I know. He goes on to say, in the paragraph we were in. He says, this would result in profound epistemological skepticism.
Yes.
You see, that's where the amens from the Christian apologists go up. So that's our point. Your view would result in profound skepticism. His response? Well, of course, skepticism isn't right, so this is hardly an implication of his view that Taylor anticipated. Well, that also shows why you don't want to interpret Taylor in the strongest form. And so what's he do? Hort comes down and he says, nope, I'm not going that way. Let us try another interpretation. Why? Creel did a pretty good job, didn't he? We don't like Creel's interpretation. In fact, it might not even have been what Taylor anticipated. So what? You better deal with that interpretation. He never does. I'll finish this up. The last sentence on page 151. A naturalistic account of the reliability of our sensory and cognitive faculties may be wrong, but there is nothing inconsistent about it. And I just wrote down, he doesn't even sense the huge problem that he's up against. When he says there's nothing inconsistent, we say, no, that is the transcendental claim. It's totally inconsistent. Far from being having nothing inconsistent or a little bit or just a bit of sloppy argument, we're saying it's not possible at all. Totally inconsistent. And then I think this is humorous too. The next paragraph before the block quotation. Unfortunately, Taylor really gives no extended argument to support this view. Indeed, what he says, quote, could hardly be considered an argument at all. Remember what I told you yesterday when I explained Thomas Kuhn's approach? When you get viciously arguing incommensurable paradigms, the followers of one will write off the followers of the other and say, you're not even doing science. That's how bad it can get. And that's all he's doing here. When Taylor starts arguing in a way that you say, boy, that looks pretty good, and Creel's interpretation is even better, he says, well, that's hardly even an argument at all. Right after the quote, Taylor makes no effort to appraise the evidence for the evolutionary account of what appears as design in organisms versus the account provided by advocates of the religious hypothesis that organisms are in fact designed. And I just wrote in my margin, proof by footnoting, again. But you see, Taylor is not arguing with the details of the biological explanation. They may be correct. The point is, whatever those details are, you'll never get in a biological explanation the design that is necessary for epistemological realism. Okay. Another aspect of transcendental argumentation that is touched on is found on pages 226 to 228. This is the other half of something we began to look at yesterday. 226 to 228.
Well, he writes Creel authors on the basis that Taylor didn't take it to that degree. I mean, there are full of arguments that others have made that he takes beyond what they did.
Yeah, that's what I said. Exactly. Yeah, his methodology as a scholar has allowed him to refine, reinterpret. Now, when someone refines and reinterprets, if he has done that, that should be answered. But in this case, he says, well, let's try another interpretation. I hope, even though the first time I said it, you might have thought I was being a little pushy. I have now convinced you. Whenever he gets close to the fire, he takes off. That's why you don't have to mention Van Til, but you don't get a Van Til-type argument in this book. The man's smart enough to figure it out. In fact, it's almost handed to him on a platter over and over again, and he keeps saying, no, I'm not going to look at that. What do you make of that? I make of it that he's running from God. Yeah, that's exactly right. That's what Paul tells me. This man is going to suppress the truth. As intelligent as he is, he's becoming a fool rather than to admit the truth. Okay, in the book on page 222, he begins the argument from cumulative evidence. And the first part of it we looked at yesterday, having to do with the parallels with Kuhn and paradigmatic analysis of scientific reasoning. The fact that it's called a cumulative argument or an argument from cumulative evidence, that's the mark that it's not what kind of argument? It's not transcendental because this is piece by piece by piece. Well, I'm not going to use it in that way, but nevertheless, part of what he calls a cumulative case does look somewhat like a transcendental argument, and that's on page 226. And he tells us that Swinburne has offered an account of a cumulative argument. And this is a third of the way down the page. He argues that the probability of theism is increased by its ability to explain various phenomena. And I quote him here, Michael Martin quotes him. Theism does not have a probability close either to one or to zero, that is, from the evidence considered so far. Theism is neither very probable nor very improbable. It does not have a probability close to one because it does not have high predictive power. It is compatible with too much. There are many different worlds which a god might have brought about. Our author says, no, it's really much worse than that. And then he's going to go on basically to say it's much worse than that because if you understand explanation in the strong sense or in the weak sense, you don't get a very good argument from the theist. Let me boil it down for you. The theist is arguing, forget the cumulative side of this, that we increase the probability. I don't think we increase the probability. Because by now you've probably figured out, if I haven't said it explicitly, I don't believe in a probability argument when you're arguing transcendentally. I'm saying it's absolutely necessary. So I don't need to increase the necessity of what is necessary. So it's not a probabilistic approach. On my approach, I'm saying you can't explain the following. Now, Michael Martin, although he's answering Swinburne, might think, well, he can say this to me too. He can say, what do you mean explain? How are you using the word explain? We can explain things. And he gives these two different versions of it and so forth. On Gutting's interpretation, page 227, there are four main sorts of facts that theism purports to explain. And he says it doesn't explain any of these in the strong sense. In order for theism to explain some facts strongly, it would be necessary to know what God knows. But this is impossible. Now, this is a tip-off to you that he's not using explanation in the way of our argument. Because our argument assumes nobody could know things the way God knows them. You see, we believe God's incomprehensible. His thoughts are higher than our thoughts and so forth. And we, at best, have an anthropomorphic understanding. But of course, it's an accurate one because he gave us that anthropomorphic understanding. But nevertheless, we're certainly not claiming strong explanation because now I've got the God's eye point of view on how the eye came about or whatever it may be. So at best, it's going to have to be taken by him as a weak explanation. Well, there are other problems with how he's explaining strong explanation, but I'm going to skip them right now. The next paragraph, is theism the best of the available weak explanations? Well, how do you rate an explanation? Well, you rate it, he says, according to these four accepted criteria of explanatory adequacy. Now, of course, we could, if we wanted to, push and say, well, why those criteria? The whole question comes down to how are we to understand explanation? He says scope, accuracy, fruitfulness, and simplicity. And then Gooding goes through, and he gives us, if you will, the scorecard on this, whether atheism or theism are stronger with respect to fruitfulness, scope, etc., etc. Well, now notice when we get to fruitfulness, what Gooding says. He says that's really an irrelevant factor of rating explanations. He says an account can be fruitful only to the extent that it is predictive Only by making predictions can it make us aware of new phenomena or new interpretations of phenomena. But neither theism nor naturalism is a predictive account. Both make sense of facts that are well known. They do not lead us to the experience of new facts. Well, I can understand what he's saying, that this is not an argument between two theories that are trying to tell us how much more we can gain knowledge of auto mechanics if you approach it this way rather than that. So that's true. It doesn't have that kind of prediction fruitfulness. But I put in my margin, the real question is, on which worldview is prediction meaningful? And then there was he didn't even bother to think about the transcendental power of explanation. As what comports with prediction. Forget what the specific predictions are about auto mechanics or, you know, how you cure malaria or whatever it may be. We don't have to have specific predictions if our claim is prediction itself is meaningless on the naturalist worldview. So I'm going to redo the score for you on explanation here. Page 228. According to Michael Martin, following Gooting, who has the better explanatory power, naturalism or supernaturalism? He says, in terms of scope, they're the same. They're equal. They're both trying to explain everything. In terms of accuracy, he says naturalism is superior. Well, my response to that is naturalism can't make sense of accuracy. Mm-hmm. Accuracy is an even shorter form of what we have shortened as epistemological realism. You see, you can't rate accuracy if you're not an epistemological realist. But we've already seen that epistemological realism doesn't fit into the atheist worldview, so there's no question of accuracy. Fruitfulness, I've already told you, well, if fruitfulness is interpreted as prediction power, there's no prediction power in naturalism at all. The score is zero. Okay, so you have supernaturalism, whatever the score is, let's say 100, naturalism zero on accuracy, supernaturalism on fruitfulness 100, naturalism zero, simplicity, well, our author says naturalism is superior. I've already warned you that simplicity is a slippery sort of thing. And I'm going to come back to it and admit that. But for the time being, when he says that, just prima facie, that's a strange thing to say. Because the naturalistic explanation of the way this world came about is very complicated. In fact, you already know that I've got the simpler explanation because when he wants to, Michael Martin ridicules this as being kind of a study school superstitious approach to the world. What a simplistic moron, you know, to say, oh, the way the world got here is God made it. You see? Yeah, it doesn't give you a lot of information about how God did it, but it does explain it. And so it turns out you might want to say we've really got the simpler explanation. But then he said, yeah, but your simple explanation doesn't have a lot of fruitfulness to it. And I say, yeah, but fruitfulness can be gained if you go beyond this and do some research. Whereas on your worldview, no research is even relevant to gaining fruitfulness. So I can resurrect to that. But I want to admit that in the end, what you consider simple, what you consider complex, is going to be governed by your worldview commitments.
Can you use the argument you use for accuracy, for simplicity? Your worldview can't count?
Yeah. Your worldview can't make sense of the difference between one and many, so how could it possibly make sense of the difference between complex and simple? Yeah, I appreciate this. You guys are doing this because you can go level upon level upon level. Just remember this in practice, though, that when you talk to people like Michael Martin and others, their first thing they're going to say is, you're just making an assertion. That's not an argument. You say, oh, yeah, well, of course, on your worldview, transcendental considerations are not considered arguments. They're always considered question begging or, you know, mere assertion or dogmatism. And when you say what you just did, you're going to get people who are going to say, yeah, we can account for it. We've got naturalistic accounts for this sort of thing. And I'll prove it. Here's my footnote.
Huh.
See, all I want, whenever somebody says we can account for it, all I want to say is, name that tune. Do it. Give me the account.
Their footnote will be research in the future. They have faith in the future.
Well, that's another out. But on this assumption, it's like, well, somebody has explained that. Go read it here. But I want you to explain it. I'm talking to you, because if there is an answer, you should be able to rough it out for me. Because what I'm going to do when I read the other guy is do an internal critique of what he thinks he's accomplished. The fact that you think he's accomplished it doesn't in itself convince me that he's accomplished it. So the only way you can get me to believe it is you'd better run the argument past me and see if I can knock it down or not.
That's their pointing of the finger. Footnoting. It's their pointing of the finger, not the counting of what the pointing of the finger means.
I think we're mixing our illustrations, but yeah, they are just pointing a finger and saying that should be enough for you.
Usually what I'm sure what Michael Martin means is simple in the sense that you have one more entity than we do. Granted, it's ambiguous, but in one sense, I think we got to argue with their accountants if they need more entities than they claim they do, which we'll come back with. But I think we're just saying, well, when we start counting types of different things, you add one more, namely God, and we stop.
Yeah, that's fine. Thanks for that, offering that interpretation. The comeback to that is, how do you count types of entities? And you've got a more complicated way of counting than we do. All right, so, I mean, I realize that he'd say that. He'd say, well, okay, when we count up the sorts of things that appear in your explanations, there's more in yours than there are in ours. Another way to come back is to say, yeah, and that's why we can explain things that you can't explain. So what we're getting at is, how can you match our adequacy of explanation without adding the entity that you didn't want to count? So in the end, the simplicity thing, it just doesn't help the argument one way or another.
It's like saying, Martin says, I have five English books, and yours is a lot more complex because you have a grammar book with it that explains English books. It's that grammar book that actually makes it simple.
Yeah.
You understand all that.
Exactly.
On scope, what do you give the score on scope?
I'm willing to say they're trying to explain everything. We're trying to explain everything. If you didn't like that, if you wanted to bear down, you might say, actually, we've got a greater scope of explanation because things you can't explain, you say, aren't there to be explained. You understand what I'm saying? See, if I were going to explain everything I know about the world, I'd have to include how is it that people make choices and moral evaluations are attached to those choices. But now, since they don't believe that people make choices in the way that I do and that there are moral absolutes that exist, then they don't have as big a scope of things to account for. Well, they only, you know, that comes about, though, because whatever doesn't, you know, whatever's not caught in my net ain't a fish, as Van Til would put, you know. Okay, now here's my argument from explanation. My argument is very simple. I said this to Mr. Tobish in my recent debate. He didn't catch the significance of it. I tried to press it on him. I'm sure I could do a better job. But he should have got it, and I hope you'll get it here. My argument is that every event is evidence for God's existence. He kept pushing us. Well, where's the evidence for God's existence, you know? This invisible friend of yours, God, where's the evidence? And I said, everything's evidence. Well, of course, he never understood that I meant that as a transcendental claim. So now I'm going to explain it to you, because this comes back like, are we explaining? Are we explaining? And I'm saying everything is evidence for God's existence. I take as my illustration the flower growing in the garden. Okay? And I'm saying the flower growing in the garden is evidence for God's existence. Because atheism cannot explain its origin. Or if you will, it can't explain the origin of matter from which the flower evolved. Secondly, atheism cannot explain the history of the flower and its development because atheism can't make sense out of induction. So there are no causal principles that it can appeal to. Thirdly, atheism cannot explain its conceptual relations. Why do I consider that a flower rather than a bear? You know, and then what's the relationship between propositions about the flower and other propositions? It can't account for the principles of logic. Fifthly, atheism cannot explain value judgments about the flower, be they aesthetic or moral. Somebody might say, you shouldn't put fertilizer on that flower. Or, you know, flowers ought to be given to the one you love. Whatever. Whenever people talk about the flower, aesthetically, morally, that can't be accounted for. Sixthly, atheism cannot explain the flower's adaptation to its own environment or to my purposes. Atheism can't make sense out of adaptation, be it causal or purposive adaptation. Next, atheism cannot explain why explanation is called for. It can't surmount skepticism regarding what we know about the flower. In that sense, it can't explain the flower because the skeptic, whatever he says, you can't surmount that. And then finally, atheism cannot explain our consciousness of the flower. After all, if the flower and I are just different levels of complexity of matter, why is the flower not conceive of me, but I conceive of the flower? And so, just add them up here. It cannot explain origin, history, development, conceptual relations, value judgments, adaptation, explanation, consciousness, or surmount skepticism. Now that's what I mean when I say everything is evidence for God's existence. You can take any fact you want, and from that fact alone, see that you have to believe in God or you couldn't make sense of the fact. You couldn't explain. Now, on this approach, which you can say is clearly transcendental, obviously, Christianity has far greater explanatory power, doesn't it? Now, what's the comeback to this? The only possible escape when I've shown that Christianity has greater explanatory power. The atheist can tell us we don't need those explanations. That's what I've had atheists tell me all along. I'll say, well, what is it that makes sense out of induction? What does it make sense out of the laws of logic? I say, we just take those things for granted. Everybody takes those things for granted. We don't need an explanation. You know why they don't need an explanation? Because what their net doesn't catch ain't fish. So here, one would ordinarily think the sorts of things I talked about are what philosophers over the ages have argued over. Christianity can make sense of what we take for granted and what philosophers argue about. But now we're being told that's not really important. You can just kind of dish all of that. Well, I conclude that Christianity does have greater explanatory power. Do you have any questions? Comments about what we've been going over?
I have a question in terms of an analogy. You use the analogy of us starting with the full house. Speaking our apologetic, would a similar analogy be in terms of the crossword puzzle? We've got the entire crossword puzzle put together. It portrays the entire picture. We can see the whole thing in its total. The unbeliever, or even the, say, uneducated Christian, has got bits and pieces of the crossword puzzle. They've just dumped that on the table. Some of the pieces are over, some of them are upside down.
Yeah.
But they look at each individual piece and therefore can't discern what it's supposed to mean or present.
Yeah, if you try to do it one piece at a time, you'll never be able to get the puzzle put together. Now, you have to understand, though, the defect in the analogy is the reason why people go one piece at a time is that they know what the picture is supposed to look like, and so now they're trying different combinations to get them together. But if you didn't know this was a crossword puzzle and you just had the pieces, what would you do with the pieces?
Well, see, I would say they've got the pieces without the box top.
Yeah, okay.
In terms of not knowing what...
But basically, this is a contrast between schools of argumentation. And we're not trying to say, I've got this piece, I've got this piece, I've got this piece, and eventually I'll have a picture. What we're trying to say is, we've got a picture here. Now, you try to take one piece out, you can't make sense of that piece. I think that probably is a little bit better way of approaching it. Well, I've gotten through half of what I promised myself I'd do in our first session this morning. So, for that reason, I punish you. You get a short break.
This recording has been released into the public domain by the Bonson Institute. Duplication, sharing, and distribution is encouraged. For more information about the life and ministry of Dr. Greg L. Bonson, visit our website, bonsoninstitute.com, where we aim to bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ.